Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis. Continuing our conversations about the cultures of consciousness. I was reading the other week a marvelous book, Forbidden Science, which are the journals that the UFO researcher and technologist, early networking technologist Jacques Vallée wrote when he was in California in the 1970s, which, as listeners know, is a high point of my own interests at the moment. And it's called California Hermetica. And it's a marvelous book because Vallée himself is a very interesting guide to a very wild and woolly time. On the one hand, he's, you know, fascinated by UFOs, by altered states of consciousness. He gets very interested in esoteric orders and occult practices, parapsychology, and, you know, his increasing theories about what's actually going on with these peculiar phenomena. But at the same time, he's a pretty level-headed guy. He's very cultured, pretty intellectual. He's a scientist. He's interested in rationality, and he's very resistant to woo. So it's a really marvelous blend, as just in general, but it's a great way into this very weird time and place. And one of the charms of the book, one for me, was his friendship with Anton LaVey, who he meets, you know, just because he's sort of interested in checking out occult stuff, and who he discovers that, unlike most of the characters that he's talking to, is actually, you know, extremely intelligent, intellectually reflective, and very creative person. And he, you know, says, and I wanted to read just a couple things he says about LaVey. One, he says, behind his charlatan's front, Anton has built a mind cathedral, not to an obsolete Satan, as he wants his followers to believe, but to that major power of our time, the secret goddess of absurdity. And this, you know, connects up with Robert Anton Wilson and other things. But it's a later quote that really struck with me and that I thought about today as I was preparing for our talk with our guest, Carl Abrahamson, who I will introduce in a moment. What Jacques Vallée writes here is they're discussing the role of initiation, and Anton was sort of surprised that Vallée had figured some things out. And Vallée goes on to say, contrary to his popular Black Pope image, Anton's view of esoteric reality is that all cults and sects are bound to fail. Instead, he believes in isolated scholars living and thinking in splendid remoteness with a few trusted friends, in contempt of the insults from pedants and bigots. For me, this really struck home because I guess personally, I've always kind of wrestled with this issue of groups and sects and lodges and such. As I've been interested in pursuing things that are both researches of an intellectual nature and also of a sort of experiential nature. And there's something about that really resonated with me, particularly because it resonated with the sense I have of the importance of resonance, which means that as you proceed through the world, there are certain people, places, texts, objects, recordings, sites, discussions that resonate with you, and that part of the way one proceeds is to pursue intelligently those resonances, and that notion of this sort of kind of a network of individual minds and hearts working not so much in concert but in kind of mutual resonance and inspiration was something that I really got from the book that is our topic of discussion today, which is a new collection by Carl Abrahamson, who is a marvelous figure in occulture, a writer, a filmmaker, photographer, artist with a very interesting history in a variety of different modern occult currents, including being friends with LaVey and working with the Church of Satan, including the Temple of Psychic Youth and Genesis Peorge, who comes up with the idea of occulture, as well as the OTO and working with the Lamech currents. But all of that is actually kind of not as interesting as what he does with this, which is to bring cultural themes and topics and ways of being into a more direct confrontation with culture in general, with art. What does it mean to make art? What is the purpose of art today? How are these things kept alive in the face of what in some ways is becoming a very idiotic, technologically driven culture? And so I'm very inspired by this book, but partly it was because I found myself resonating with it in a number of ways, in terms of a certain kind of position of participant observation, a certain kind of reflection on these things, a resistance to the kind of a fundamentalism that make no mistake, occultism and subcultural radicalism can produce just as much as other forms of cultural positioning. So I'm very happy that that Carl's on the show today, and I look forward to our conversation very much. But first, we'll talk with, of course, our co-host, Maja Davu, Skyping in from Los Angeles. Hey, Maja.
Hi, Eric. You know, I really like what you just said about the absurdity and the Anton LaVey thing, because that it's so resonant with a lot of stuff, obviously, that, you know, you and I like. We like the joke, the big joke's on you. It's like whenever you get a group of people, they're in doing anything, but certainly occultism and magic is no exception. There's a certain capacity for everything to go in a big Lord of the Flies direction. So it's really necessary. Somebody has to be that person that's able to be like, ha, everything's stupid, or else everybody gets like really intense on these Lord of the Fly melodramas, and it's like always what the whole occult thing is trying to pop everybody out of. So I always love things that look at the systems within the systems and how they get eaten by things that they're trying to conquer and all those things. So when we look at investigations into initiatic or cult things, I always know if someone's making jokes about it, it's on the right stream.
Absolutely. No, it's perfect. It again, touches on some of the points that Carl makes in his essays in the book. But with that, let's bring Carl onto the show. Carl, thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind. Are you there? Hello?
Mercury retrograde, dude.
That's it. Hello.
Hi, Eric.
Excellent. Good to hear you.
Likewise.
Very good. So are you in Stockholm at the moment?
At the moment, yes.
And you've been there for a long... Did you grow up there?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a total Stockholm child.
I had a wonderful experience in Stockholm once. I was there around late May, so the nights were very short, and yep. I was walking around. I couldn't sleep, and so I left my hotel, and I was walking around, you know, in the middle of the night about, 1 o'clock at night or something, 1 to 2. And I was walking, and I got very hazy. It was so beautiful, the old town, and I was in, you know, some kind of romantic reverie. Yeah. And then very subtly, it was, you know, and it was the beauty of the dusk, you know, the late dusk, just when night is about to fall. And I had that emotional quality of that late, you know, crepuscular moment. And then almost at the edge of my peripheral vision, I suddenly felt an entirely new emotion, a sense of springing life, of a kind of freshness. And I realized that it had shifted into dawn. And but I didn't recognize it. My body recognized it. My body knew. It was like, wait, no, we've shifted. Now there's more light. But it was so subtle you couldn't see it rationally. But it zapped my whole emotional reverie and really taught me a lot about how the body and the deep wisdom of the body informs our reverie, our imagination, our you know, sense of spirit. So I have an incredibly vivid memory of Stockholm at night from that.
Sounds like a literal twilight zone.
Exactly. There we go. But it wasn't. That was one thing. I, you know, we think, you know, in America it's like, oh, you know, they got it all made in Sweden, and it's, you know, it's all sort of well organized. It's always, you know, it's all, everything works really well, and they don't fight about the socialized medicine. It seems great, right? And And but I don't necessarily think about it as a place with a really, really rich and wild subculture, and it's only or set of subcultures. And it's only been as I've learned more by paying attention to, you know, individuals like yourself and other and other folks, that it was really a very, very, and you know, still is, but certainly in a period of the 70s and the 80s. That there was a lot of very interesting underground activity that you were really a part of, doing fanzines, playing in bands, you know, being involved in cultural groups and psychic use. So tell me about that period.
Well, I think that we have to begin sort of mid-80s, because that's when things started to get conscious within me. I was then around 19. And I had, of course, been immersing myself, as you do as a teenager, in occultism, in cool music, all these things that were going on at the time. But I think what happened then in the early 80s was that there was this intellectualism going on within the confines of experimental music. And when you got interested in the music, there were so many references, both in the music per se and in the lyrics and the records. And when I started, you know, just being like a cultural detective, trying to find out who the sources were, etc., and just coming across names like Crowley and Spare and LaVey and Burroughs and Geising and all these people who, you know, had been doing such interesting work for a long time, and also a long time ago. So suddenly these were integrated within a cultural scene, predominantly with music, but also in a sense with movies. And I was just knocked over. It blew my mind that so many things and so many people could be so substantial and interesting. So I was lost already there.
Well, I love that. I love that idea of the cultural detective, and that's again one of the things I like in your book, Resonances. Yeah. Is that I really get that sense of things too, and you for me, you model a way of both being a researcher, investigator, curious, even a little detached but fascinated, and yet at the same time not staying with that position, willing to take those things and take them somewhere, make them creative, bring them into a more vital existence in your own life. Has that kind of those two sides of the equation always been part of it for you, or have you had to come figure out how to balance those two sides of yourself over the years?
I think it has changed over the years. Initially, you know, when you're really young, you are like a sponge. You know, everything is interesting. You take in a lot of things. But then, of course, these topics, whether it's magic or psychedelic stuff, they work on such deep levels too that you cannot control it consciously and you cannot be aware of it all the time. Sort of it's like seed. So I think what happened was that when I had immersed in my own experimentation and intellectual research, then things started to grow within me in a way, like a flower or some strange you know, concoction in my mind. And then I think the perspective changed because I got a better overview. And then I realized that basically what I'm doing in the sense research and writing, lecturing, it is a kind of anthropology. And I decided to call that, you know, magico anthropology, because that's a term that fits all these topics. And I think I've stuck with that. I feel very comfortable. You know, sometimes I have a hard time answering people. They ask me, so what are you or what do you do? And, you know, to give that answer, I'm a magical anthropologist, feels pretty good because it can encompass so many different things and all these things that have interested me, most of them still do. So, you know, that's me. I'm a magical anthropologist.
Yeah, it's a wonderful phrase. I mean, I've found myself in very similar zones in that I really did a lot of my own research, both personally and intellectually, by becoming a participant observer in a variety of scenes and a lot of similar kinds of scenes on, you know, in a stateside sense. But the whole model of anthropology and the opportunity in anthropology, even as an academic discourse, if that's important. But even as an academic discourse, there's a space in it for the kind of ambiguity of the participant observer, for a sort of slippage. Sure. I mean, any anthropologist worth their salt, even the most, you know, diehard rationalist ones, recognize the strange things that happen when you kind of immerse yourself in another language and another kind of world view. And it's a marvelous set of tools to bring to cultural life and one's own cultural exploration.
Sure, absolutely. No, I mean, it's just I also like very much the perspective of the you know, almost like this voyeuristic perspective. However, that's not been my central perspective. I have immersed myself very much, sometimes too much even. But this thing where you can, you know, occasionally just step aside or sort of hover from above, just see an overview. It's highly, highly interesting. But then to get the grasp of things, sometimes you need to be in there also to really leave the theory, to leave the intellectualism, and just get a feel for what people are doing. You know, it's just you need to be like a field agent.
Yeah, very much. Well, when you think about all of the various plunges that you've taken over your life, yeah. What can you talk about one of the more important ones? For example, I would really like to hear about the Temple of Psychic Youth and your involvement in that at a very, very interesting time. Mm-hmm. When they were really the predominant sort of, institution isn't the right word, but sort of organized, self-conscious cultural organism across, mm-hmm. in multiple countries that were really, providing these seeds that came from the past as well as were deeply embedded in what was happening in the 80s and you know, the experimental now as well as the kind of historical resonance of these things. It was such an important and kind of in some ways under-acknowledged point of cultural creativity, and I just love to hear about some of your experiences there.
Yeah, sure. Basically, what happened was that since Topi as an entity formed or got together sort of in the early 80s, they had this thing where you could subscribe to their information and newsletters. And I was by then a diehard music fan. You know, I loved Throbbing Gristle, and I, you know, followed along when it became Psychic TV. And then for me, it was just natural to subscribe to the newsletters and the information and the mail order catalogs. Is very exciting stuff. And again, like what I said before, was this entire musical scene really immersed in more, you know, intellectual source material. And Topi was exactly that. So I decided this is very interesting. I already knew that I love to produce stuff in printed matter, love to write, love to, you know, be an editor in a way. And I had already by then had a fanzine about comic books, and I was working on fanzine about sort of rock and roll and sleazy movies. So I was already involved in my own cottage industry operation. So it's like two very interesting strains merged in that I became active in Scandinavia, created something called Topi Scan, which was an access point, meaning it was somewhere people could, you know, send letters and inquire about what was going on with Topi in the region, you know, Sweden, Denmark, Norway. And it happened, you know, people were very interested. And once we had the address on, you know, Psychic TV albums and publications, it was just like many, many doors to, you know, unknown encounters opened. Highly exciting times. And also, it wasn't only, you know, me, and soon there was a small group, and we kept in touch with the, you know, main people in the UK, and also Topi US was also active. So there was this kind of, you know, pre-internet kind of network where you exchanged information that was, you know, hard to get, perhaps, or consciously occulted by control forces, or, you know, what have you. It was just a very open-minded and an attitude of, you know, opening the door. If you were interested in something, you know, by all means, go ahead, you know.
Well, let me ask you, did you counterly receive any kind of resistance to that? Because I know I always am interested in people who are able to create those pockets of free thinking and kind of what the sacrifice is, especially if it's about notorious or supposedly notorious material. So did you get any flack, or did you find it was pretty amenable to kind of create that community in an outside pocket and remain unaffected?
I think it's very, very much a regional thing and a cultural thing. Me, being in Sweden and, you know, being active with my Swedish friends and also, you know, Scandinavian friends, there were never any problems whatsoever because we're in such a, you know, liberal environment. Whereas I know several times Genesis Peorage, who was one of the, you know, founders and originators of this construct, he had a lot of problems in the UK.
Yeah.
I mean, London and the UK in general is just an incredibly conservative environment at the time. So he got slack. He got slack from you know, the gutter press and also from police. But then again, they were always more, you know, radical. He has always been a very radical person, and he has also been, you know, a person that the media, they always love him, you know, whether to scandalize or to, you know, salute. It doesn't matter, you know, because he's such a strong character.
Well, one of the things that's interested me about actually learning more about Scandinavia's sort of role in occultural work and sort of underground stuff is that it's weird. It's like the relative absence of these kinds of forces of control or direct aggression from the state or from media or whatever didn't seem to actually, you know, it proves that you don't necessarily need to actually be fighting on a day-to-day level to do something really interesting.
Yeah, no, it's true. I found it remarkable because there are, in terms of occultism or, you know, these modern appropriations and newly created magical orders, etc., there have been a lot. And, you know, with time, you know, all you have to do is give something time and you can see whether it has any value or any substance. And many, many things that grew out of that era, sort of mid to late 80s, has been quite vital and has had effects around the world. So in that sense, it's a little bit like there's this thing called the Swedish music phenomenon. It's sort of like the IKEA of pop music, where people are very skilled in making stuff that may not be quite original, but still it's a nice assembly of ideas and you know, concepts, and then it's very easy to market. I'm not saying that all the Swedish occultists are like IKEA in that sense, or even, you know, pop stars, but we have this thing very, very seldom, you know, there comes along someone from Scandinavia who's totally, totally new, unique, you know, groundbreaking, unfortunately. But there are many people who are intelligent and educated and, you know, capable of creating syntheses. And that, I think, is the Scandinavian model, this kind of assembling interesting stuff and, in a way, repackaging it.
Yeah, and that there's another element to that I find that at least I've gotten out of your work, and it may take me a little bit to get there, is that in the more extreme characters, the very original characters, there is this kind of extremism, and that can be associated also with a sort of, you know, danger or craziness or highly disruptive or very negative or a kind of violence. Like those are, there's sort of a there can be negative sides to that sort of originality. And what I get from your perspective that I find very appealing and also I think very healthy is that while you recognize the importance of these kind of limit experiences, both on an occult level and on a subcultural level, that they're the kind of intensity, that there's also equally a place for, I'm not exactly sure how to characterize it, but I would call it a kind of humanism, a kind of a little bit more of an appreciation for the ordinary, for the way in which the magical world and the ordinary world of being a creative person, of dealing with work, of sitting at your desk, of dealing with other people, of being in the media, that's just as important a place. Whereas I think there's a kind of almost an immaturity or a sort of romanticism in a lot of subcultures then and now, where it's all about the extreme and who's the one who's breaking through, and whereas it's really more complicated, and there's there are reasons to look at both sides.
Mm, absolutely. But I think that I have never been, in my own mind, I have never been extreme. I know that other people, you know, more normal people perhaps think that I've been extreme. But still, I've always been the same, you know, kind of mild-mannered, fairly well-dressed, you know, sort of like an intellectual, basically. And I think that what's, made people turn their head a bit is just why a person like me has these very, very weird interests. That would surely be something for psychoanalysis. We'll leave it for now.
but I think
when you're young, you're wanting to compensate, you know, possible feelings basically a compensation. And when you go to the most extreme things, and when you deal with these highly, you know, attractive and romantic occult strains from history, and you try things out, and it's just fascinating, of course you get an ego inflation. It, you know, it's the same. All youth, all young people go through that in different ways. But I think it's especially sort of, you know, precarious in a way, and possibly dangerous when you deal with occultism. I survived, I'm happy to say, and I'm now in a position where I think that if you can't apply any kind of psychedelic teaching or any kind of magical teaching on a practical day-to-day level, you're, you know, almost off the grid. You have to be able to apply this wisdom or knowledge that you find on your own path. That's very important. And also, I think that one of the things that I have written a lot about and lectured about, and also is sort of touched upon in Resonances, is this thing where I've begun to question whether the terminology of occultism and magic, you know, the arcane stuff, the symbolism, maybe it's outdated. And then I tried to find a substitution, and then I've drifted more into a general creative language, you know, things like transformation and, you know, basically creativity and using art as old school kinds of talismans with sigils. You know, it's not a matter of changing the process, but changing the language and the terminology so that it fits today, so that people can use it in a very, you know, in an applicable way. Because also what's alluring and fascinating when you're young can also become a turnoff and a stigmatizing thing when you grow up and, you know, have to face completely different kinds of responsibilities. So it's a matter of seeing the core, seeing the very process of what it is that can change things. That's my, you know, pet project right now.
Yeah, that's, you know, a very vital kind of question, and it really goes to this question of what a culture is, which is that there, the in a way, for all sorts of reasons, the occult has been, you know, in many ways, intentionally kind of cut off, esoteric. There's a wall. There's a sort of a cell around the thing. Yeah. And what we're seeing now, and this is sort of the next sort of zone I want to go into, although we got to take a break in just a second. But what we're seeing now is a, you know, on the one hand, a mass absorption of these memes and languages from esoterica, from the occult, from folklore, from psychedelia into the, you know, the culture at large, into the internet, into film, into role-playing games, into online slang. You know, in many ways, scholar Christopher Partridge wrote a great essay recently just called "A Culture is Ordinary." And it's a very interesting way of like shifting and actually kind of acknowledging that these things, on the one hand, aren't so esoteric and secret anymore. Yeah. And at the same time, that also demands that the spirit of the thing change, because it cannot continue to exist in the bric-a-brac especially the bric-a-brac that's more easily absorbed into what's frankly, and you're very honest about this and I appreciate it in your book, very superficial kind of material, that the sort of explosion of the occult imagination in pop culture today is not necessarily something for, you know, serious esoteric or transformative people to celebrate necessarily. It's a complicated thing. It's not just a sign of like, oh great, there's Harry Potter, magic is back. You know, it's a more insidious and at least complicated situation to that. And that seems like something you're very focused on.
Absolutely. I think basically if we can boil it down to, you know, the concept of the mind, you can look at the mind from inside, but you could also look at it from the outside. And in the mind, all these things have been going on, you know, through millennia, through centuries, through the latest decades. And as with everything in our world right now, and as, you know, things are moving, you know, exponentially faster, which means that ideas are almost like milk or food. You know, everything has a sell-through date, and that speed or apparent need of change and evolution is just more and more rapid. And I think that what used to be very, very you know, radical, say again in the early 80s, these ideas sprouted up and, you know, communal living came back and you could try working together on magical rituals and sigils. That's now almost, you know, as you say, pop culture. And I think the more the radical stuff is happening within science today. I mean, physics and you know, the natural sciences, they're dealing with concepts that, you know, 50 years ago belonged among the more far-fetched science fiction authors. But today, it's not only a reality, it's like a meta-reality of you know, huge proportions and huge potential for change, for changing our life. So in that sense, and also I was thinking about one aspect of occultry is actually how esotericism in general has now drifted into academia. You know, there are many universities who have chairs now for esoteric studies, and a lot of conferences, loads of books being published. This, I think, is a good thing. However, it doesn't contain the seeds of transformation because it's so distanced from the transformative process. Still, as a matter of you know, acknowledgement and respect, I think it's phenomenal. It's just fantastic.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, that's right at the crux where I am. As you know, I decided to go get a PhD partly because the zone was warming to all this, and because a lot of my work has been, you know, fairly scholarly. Some of it more in pop writing, and some of it more in academic journals. So I was like, oh, this will be a great opportunity. And it's very interesting as I'm actually, you know, writing my project now. I'm used to passing on the seeds. My work has always, even if when it was sort of apparently superficial, if you were paying attention, there's seeds in everything. It's all about, hey, I'm just an observer here, kind of. I'm sort of a participant, but check this out. And there's little things planted along the way. And I can feel the way that the form doesn't really allow for that in certain ways. So it's a very interesting challenge. And I still haven't decided what I'm going to turn my work into, partly because I feel, in terms of actually publishing it, like I can write a dissertation and that'll be fine. But like, do I actually, I'm still on the seed side of things. And I, you know, and then like I meet my colleagues and I'm like, do they look at me weird? Cause they know that I'm not really like, I'm still a disseminator. You know, I'm still in the current. And it's a real funny place to be. It's kind of fun actually, but it's a weird place to be. Anyway, I'm going on about my own thing. We got to take a break right now. We're talking with Carl Abrahamson on Expanding Mind. And we'll be right back after these messages.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Majadou. We're here with Erica Davis, and today we're speaking with Carl Abrahamson on resonances and different connecting points in the occult world that he has experienced. So before the break, you were mentioning a little bit about the importance of being able to practically apply this kind of material. And I was wondering if you, in your experiences, have found a particular kind of place where that can be done. Or do you feel like it's more about just kind of getting that conscious date and then putting it into everything, or have you kind of been focusing on specific ways that that can kind of be brought in to, you know, just regular life on planet Earth?
Well, that's a very mind-expanding question you pose there. I think that Crowley summed it up well in terms of Thelema and sort of this philosophy of will, and, you know, you have to find your way and you have to find your will, and then, of course, also be honest and work with it. Crowley wasn't the only one who formulated this, but let's say that, you know, let's use him as a symbol. Crowley's intention wasn't that everyone needs to become a technical magician, meaning, you know, learn his magical system or be involved in this kind of, you know, ritualized hocus pocus. It was basically and still is a philosophy of will. And self-knowledge is paramount, of course, and then you have to, you know, find something that makes your you know, apprehension and also life in general just valuable, that it feels meaningful. And then we drift into other kinds of philosophies like, you know, existentialism, etc., etc. I have always had a bit of a problem in this sense because at the same time as I, as an individual, you know, I've been developing myself in a certain direction, let's call it a creative direction, and I feel very happy about that. But at the same time, a huge integrated part of that creativity has also been about these subjects, you know, meaning self-development, strategies for survival, mind expansion, magic, all these, you know, very in themselves, you know, inherently creative things. So I've been on my path, but at the same time, I've also been immersing myself in all of these other things. So basically, I'm not saying that I've felt schizophrenic, but it's been like a two-edged sword. Sometimes I haven't really known whether to pursue, you know, almost from an egotistical point of view, just my own, doing my own thing, or perhaps slightly later in life, realizing that all of this philosophical stuff, all of these, you know, wonderful thoughts, they also need to be a part of my own creativity.
So would you say maybe more like a fuel for your other creative activities?
No, I don't think so. Absolutely, it's totally inspirational stuff. But, you know, very early on, I was a bit, you know, flabbergasted at not only, you know, finding books and stuff like that, but I found myself at an early age so welcome in this world of, you know, phantasmagoria. It was just amazing to go to San Francisco and on the same trip meet Anton LaVey and then Kenneth Anger in LA and hang out with the OTO when I was just a new sort of Minerval. And it was just remarkable. And my life was like that, and to an extent still is, meaning I have many interesting meetings and sort of synchronicities. And when I was younger, I was just, you know, basically going, wow, this is fantastic. But later on, I tried to formulate or understand what was actually going on. And I simply think that I have a certain kind of creativity, and I work with that. A part of that is, you know, assembling and then presenting back all the stuff that I've been taught, basically. That's not saying that I'm a teacher of any kind, but I think that I am an editor. You know, I repackage things for perhaps, let's call it, a new generation or some kind of, you know, cultural shift. And Resonances is one example of that, where I sort of write about many different things. And one of the goals I had with that was basically it should be like a primer, you know, for kids today or kids in the future. Can you say, what the hell was going on in 2014? Now, you know, if they read the book, they will understand.
No, that's great. But I was thinking of the word curator, which is, it kind of came and went already in our quick internet age as a valid term, you know, first it starts out as curation and you get the sense, and then it becomes so widespread that anything you're doing, you know, assembling anything is like curation, and it doesn't really mean anything. But that aspect of editing and bringing together, you know, comes through very strongly. And I just wanted to mention also that you edit a wonderful magical journal, the Fenris Wolf, that's been I think we're in seven issues now, and the recent ones are very fat, so it's like getting a big long book, so it's no mere zine anymore. You know, I know it once was a zine long ago, you know, that's a lot of fun. I wanted to ask you about one of the essays in the book that really struck me, because it's been things that I've been thinking about and writing about, is this question about the sorcery of fiction. And you have this line in it about how the fiction of sorcery has turned into the sorcery of fiction. And I've been thinking a lot about fictions and how do we play with fictions and how do we see the world through this mode and how things are changing now with the internet and with the entertainment complex and all that. So could you – what do you mean by that? The fiction of sorcery has turned into the sorcery of fiction.
Well, I think it's both a potential and it's also a reality. I don't know if there was some point in time and space where things changed and, you know, fiction overrode fact, so to speak. But basically, you could say that today we are immersed in, you know, so much fiction. You know, we have never experienced anything like it, you know, whether it's through, you know, technology or our phones or computers or TV or movies or all these kinds of digital displays. Different kinds of storytelling with different kinds of purposes. Some is just, you know, plain commercial advertising. Some is artistic, etc., etc. But the thing is, it's all over the place. And I remember, you know, when I was young, it wasn't there to that extent. So we have this, again, an exponential increase of something that is, you know, technically not real, you know, real within quotation marks. But it's just... you can then become paranoid and say, you know, why is this happening? Who's behind this? And why do you discourage, or why are we being discouraged from checking out the real stuff? Basically, you know, qualitative journalism, accounts of science progress, stuff like that. So in that sense, maybe there is a conspiracy. I don't know. Some days I think so. Some days I don't. But This shift also how you know, you can use fiction for sorcery, that's again a parallel strain to what we talked about before. This thing where, you know, whereas in the old days you could maybe, you know, have your confined temple space and get dressed up in robes and use, you know, fancy wands and stuff like that, but at the same time today it might be more potent and more transformative to have a really clever blog, you know, to affect that change in accordance with one's own will. Not necessarily occult in the sense hidden or esoteric or symbolic, but really transforming. And when, if you work with art, which is in a way a kind of fiction or a personalized aestheticized filter, you can, through, you know, writing fiction or making a movie or making music, basically sowing seeds in these very, again, mind-expanding, or at least potentially mind-expanding areas, you can create a lot of change. So again, we see that the current technology and the current media climate can be seen both as a control system, but each control system also contains its own rebel force. You know, the same technology can always be used for more altruistic purposes, more humanistic purposes, and it's the same thing, you know. And maybe the internet was the big thing of the 90s, and the same things were being debated back then. I can remember that, but I think, or at least my focus has been very much on thinking about, you know, why is there so much fiction around? You know, because it's just a flood.
Yeah, and it's also, I think, one of the go ahead, Maja.
Her mind has been expanded.
I seem to have lost her. Yeah. One of the things that brings to mind is it's precisely in this ambiguous space between fiction and fact that a lot of the action is happening. Both, I think, the action of control, meaning that you can glimpse the, you know, shadowy trace of the control system, whatever it is, precisely by trying to find that line between fiction and fact. And it's also that's a place where a lot of the greatest, whatever you want to call them, pranks, illuminating exercises, collective reality games are mm-hmm. going on. You know, if you think about augmented reality, you're thinking about the sort of immersive, not so much live action role playing games, but the ways of sort of playing with fiction and fact, and in a way, almost sort of updating some of the Robert Anton Wilson Illuminatus approach to things, where mix together all of these stories.
Yeah.
And in a way, I think that's a space that we're in. But of course, when I think about that, or when I imagine, I've done my own little experiments in those zones, writing under pseudonyms, writing things mm-hmm. that make claims that aren't true, but they look like they're facts because I have a journalistic voice or whatever.
Yeah.
I also go, ooh, God's scary, man. Woof. You know, it's a heavy thing, because it does seem that we're losing our grasp of the real in a lot of ways, whether
sure.
if you think about it in a kind of investigative journalist way, what's actually going on, how the 1% are, you know, setting the stage for some kind of, you know, global thing or whatever, you know, who knows? I don't even want to go there, but it's certainly the case that it's hard to find out what's actually going on, because you take two steps in that direction and you're in conspiracy land, and it's full of fiction. So it's a very, very weird thing. And how, especially thinking about now, 2014, 2015, looking ahead, not even 10 years ago, and certainly not back in the 80s or the 90s when we, you know, that were, you and I were shaped. I'm a little younger than you, but not much. Like, how is it changed? Like, where is that focus belong now?
It's kind of hard to say, I think. First of all, it is a difficult question in itself. But of course, I can see that, you know, I'm 49 right now, so I feel sort of midlife, in a way, and my own creative stuff is going really well. That's under control, so to speak. So in a way, I already feel a little bit conservative, and I can't say that I, you know, follow along. I don't, you know, follow new bands and check out sort of the latest stuff. So in that sense, I may not have a proper or correct answer as to what's going on now that's really, you know, groundbreaking in that sense. But I would say that, of course, it's in net-based and sort of, you know, podcasts and blogs are really good. The problem is that when everything is so easily accessible and so available, it loses potency in a way. It's like an inflation of information. So in that sense, you know, I could say that it's the same dynamic. You know, things that have a potential to change things immensely, really substantially, also carry with it, you know, the danger or the potential of just drowning everyone in too much of the same thing.
Yeah, that makes sense. We got, you know, a couple minutes here, and there's one sort of question I have for you. One of the things you do in Resonance is you write a number of essays where you address the kind of legacy of Aleister Crowley and mm-hmm. Thelema. And, you know, the whole question of, you know, doing one's will, you know, it's the kernel or one of the kernels of the current. And, of course, people have very different accounts of what will is in that sense. Some people, it's about a certain kind of radical individualism and a kind of libertarian, militant individuality. And other people see it, interpret it almost as more like a kind of Tao, like the will is like a kind of Tao, a kind of larger flow, et cetera, et cetera. I know it's a very complicated question, but I would really love to hear you say, you know, in terms of the ideas of Crowley that are important, this is a core one. To people who aren't necessarily interested in like the OTO and all that stuff, what is it about this teaching of will that is important, and how you define it?
Yeah. Okay, so Crowley is a very big subject. So let's just focus on the will aspect. I think when you're young, of course, you're trying to distance yourself from your background and your environment. And it's a mix of, you know, nature versus nurture. But it's both nature and nurture, of course. But one of the things where you, after you've gone through perhaps the, you know, the rebel phase and just done everything diametrically different from your parents or peers or whatever, this formulation, it's almost like a new kind of childlike phase where you say, I want. You know, that's an early child phase, but when you come out of the teenage world, it's there again. You know, I want this, I want that. Sometimes it's very, you know, lofty or not reachable, but sometimes it can also be very lucid. And when it's lucid, you feel that kind of existential resonance, and you feel on an intuitive level what's right and what's wrong for you. And then there, I would have to say, Crowley stressed that you have to go along with these intuitions. It doesn't need to be an analytical thing, you know, analyzing, do I like this or do I like that? That can be useful, but it's also a matter of, you know, existential feeling, existential intuition, very important stuff. Then one has to also keep in mind, it's also something that he wrote about, that it's not a static thing. I mean, this classic concept of the Holy Guardian Angel and this epiphany of this vision of what you should do with your life, etc. I don't buy that. I don't buy that at all. I'm not sure whether Crowley did, but, you know, we could just say, also with a lot of psychological, more recent psychological insight, that will is not static. We change as human beings. You know, the metabolism changes and our psyches change. There are cataclysms that change us, crises. All of these things makes, you know, we need to realize that will changes and it should change. So otherwise it becomes, you know, entropic in a way. It just going through the motions forever until you die. And that's not what it's about. But I think one key that Crowley didn't stress enough is this sort of self-knowledge aspect. You have to use an almost Eastern concept of, you know, the jewel in the lotus, stripping away stuff, stripping away problems, stripping away neuroses, and then you will get to the core of who you are.
Yeah, that's right. And it also has that element of process in a way. That discussion around the Holy Guardian Angel is another way of saying a point I made earlier, which is I think it's very important to shift from a kind of fetish of the one shot encounter, the single transcendence, the peak, yeah, really, and to accept that it's a process and it's more like peaks and valleys, and
sure,
and it's an ongoing kind of negotiation, which isn't quite as sexy, but it's actually where we live. At least a lot of the time. And that's not to say that those peaks aren't incredibly valuable, and sometimes it's the work to get there that's really the juice. And I think, you know, we see the same thing with psychedelic discussions as well. I mean, we could have really had this whole discussion, you know, focused on psychedelics and come up with a lot of kind of similar points of view. But you're such a creative person, as you say, and we just have a couple minutes here. What are you working on now, or what are you discovering now in your creative life?
Well, it's very interesting because I think I'm working on two main projects. One is the carrying on in this reassembly of other people's thoughts, older and also younger, in the sense that I'm making documentary films about certain artists like Kenneth Anger, like Genesis Peorage, like Michael Girard from Swans, you know, people who've really, you know, touched me through their art, and I know a lot of other people too. So that's a huge project, actually, a documentary series that will, you know, I'll be working on that for all this year. But I'm also writing my second novel, and whether that includes, you know, sorcery, I have yet to see, and the readers have yet to read. But that's basically what I'm working on now, writing fiction and also making documentary films.
I think you also interviewed Mark McLeod out here in
that's
San Francisco.
Right. Dear old Mark.
What a wonderful character. Well, I wanted to just let people know about your website, CarlAbrahamson.com, C-A-R-L. You could figure out Abrahamson, and it's got those two S's, of course.
Yep.
And Resonances, your new book on Scarlet Imprint. There is a paperback copy as well.
There is.
Excellent.
And it looks equally great.
And very worthwhile. It's got great layout. There's 23 essays. Wink, wink. And it's a joyous blend of original thinking and critical reflection on this cultural stream, which I think we both agree has a lot still a lot to say to our moment. So, Carl, thanks for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Yeah, thanks, Eric, and thank you very much. It's been a pleasure, and I'm looking forward to the next time.
Wonderful. Okay, from me and Majid, all you out there, keep your minds open.
Yeah, exactly.